but property. Because you know what? What Mr. Rose and Mrs. Class said, property. And property is what? It's your rights. Property is a collection of rights. We're going to talk about that tonight. Okay? Okay. Couple things. First, anybody got headphones in? Take them out. Secondly, anybody talking? Stop it. Okay, here we go. Last week, we did a very quick run through, very comprehensive, but quick. Particularly since we covered about 4,000 years, there's a lot of room there. But we did a history of the law. It all began in Rome. All roads lead to Rome. Rome was the first society to say we're a nation of laws, not a nation of men. That's men in the mankind sense, not the gender sense. And because of the fact that Rome viewed themselves as a nation of laws, they were the first society to come up with a system of law that needed to be respected, that needed to be permanent, and that was brought across the Roman Empire. They built an empire that lasted for over 1,000 years. Just to put that into perspective, the United States has been around for about 250 years, okay, as a government. That's 4 times as long. It's a long time. And it was because of their law. They were the first system of laws that divided their government into the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. They had a separation of powers, and they had a permanency. England was a Roman colony. Our law descends from England, but it really descends from Rome too, because it's like the double play combination. It goes from the shortstop to the second baseman all the way to first. Okay? For those of you who are baseball fans, you're a fan of Albany, the great Hall of Famer, Johnny Evers, Tinkers to Evers to chance. That was in the Chicago Cubs. He's in the Hall of Fame. Johnny Evers operated a sporting goods store here in Albany for about 70 years. His grandson now is the head of the business council here in Albany. When you go from Rome to England to the United States, it's all a legacy of law. England took that Roman law and put their own imprompter on it. That means they put their own stamp on it. What did England do? It transformed the code, which was the way that the Romans drafted their law. They drafted it by statute. And they transformed it into what we call the common law. They followed the Roman principles of law through courts. Where the Roman law was heavy on statutes, where the Senate would pass statutes called the code, and then enforce it through the executive, who was the emperor, and enforce it through the courts, it was backwards in England. England would make the law principally in the courts and then have the it concretizing statute when they wanted to through Parliament, which came up after the Magna Carta, and also through the king, who was the executive. You still had those three different branches of government. England followed that same model. Particularly after Magna Carta. What was the other term for the Magna Carta? Magna Carta is Latin meaning Great Charter. was a promise by the king. King John was captured at Runnymede after the property owners felt they were going to lose their property. They captured him, they formed an army, basically had a revolution, and said, either your signature or your brains on the contract. That contract, which became the Great Charter, Magna Carta, gave forth liberties to all the British people, principally the landlords. Now what, and this is going to be important to our case tonight, what one liberty didn't the Magna Carta grant that it probably should have? He didn't abolish involuntary servitude or slavery. Why didn't it? He gave all these other rights. Why do you think the British people, the commoners, the people in the street, called it the Charter of Liberties? Gave him a right to trial by jury. It created a parliament which they could vote for the representatives. Why do you think it didn't abolish involuntary servitude? Who brought the Magna Carta to fruition? It was the property owners. And if they abolished involuntary servitude, who were the people who worked the farms? The serfs. They were in servitude to the property owners. Now, it wasn't exactly slavery, because feudalism wasn't slavery. They were free to go, physically, unlike slavery was in this country, where they were physically in bondage. Under the feudalistic society, they just didn't have a place to go. You could leave, but then you wouldn't eat. Not much of a choice. But they didn't abolish involuntary servitude. Indeed, when the founders of our country, fast forward because we take the British model, when they formed our country, they used that Magna Carta's failure to abolish involuntary servitude for the reason of the continuation of slavery, because under British law, that was legal. It took until 1865, when we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, to abolish it in the United States. A lot of founders wanted it abolished from the get-go.
Okay. All starts in Rome, goes to England. Magna Carta frees a lot of people. Not everybody, sadly, but it frees a lot. Then you have the American Founding. The American Founding takes it to the next level. All men are created equal. They're clearly not under the Magna Carta. Only applies to property owners. In our Declaration, we apply it to everybody. Constitution applies it to everybody. We have those provisions in the Constitution, which it says all people have to be treated equally. Things like the Privileges and Immunities Clauses, things like if you are an individual person, you can't be treated differently than other people. It's called equal protection. The laws have to be applied equally. At least, that's what the Constitution says. Okay? Lastly, we have a separation of powers, which is even more significant than in Rome or in England. Why? Because we are the sovereigns. Our Constitution, which sets up our government, which sets up and declares our rights, is based upon the fact that the people are sovereign. The first three words of the American Constitution are, we the people. And the reason why it is established by that is because unlike other governments where rights come from the government,
in the United States, rights come from God, and we give the government the power. Presumably, we could abolish that, too. People like Thomas Jefferson argued that. Now, we haven't done it in 250 years, but at the end of the day, because our Constitution was ratified by the people of the United States, it was given to the people
by the people themselves. Okay. Tonight, we move forward into property law. We're going to give you definitions of property. We're going to talk about how property and the law are intertwined. We talked a little bit about that beforehand. We're going to talk about the Constitution and the Declaration and property rights flow from that. And lastly, the most important part of this course, I set it out because it will help you think throughout this course of what this framework is. You build a house on a strong foundation. The four postulates help you understand this class. By the last class, you're going to look back on those four postulates and say, wow, that's what they mean. And by that, when you think of it, you'll be able to leave that and understand all of property law. You will not pass this class unless you know the four postulates. But there are four things, and I drill them into you about 400,000 times. 100,000 per postulate. Okay? So you will know it. If when I ask you on the exam, because it'll be on the exam, and I give you what's on the exam every week, in these weekly information sheets, okay? The four postulates are on there. If you get them wrong, I cry. It's not a brain science. You don't want to see my opera. Okay? So get them right, because I want you to do well. You understand the four postulates, you understand this class, and you're good to go. Okay. Let's start about property. What is property? How important is it to a free people? How is it defined? What does it mean? What's property? It's the desk you sit at. It's the pencil in your hand. It's my car. That is my car. It's your home. That's my home. It's my puppies. That's my puppies. Sadly, one is Lady of the Magnificence, no longer with us. Sadly. Beautiful dog, but Sonny the Wonder Dog is still around and doing beautifully. My wife's best friend, I rank way low on the totem pole compared to the dog, okay? But the dog is wonderful, okay? All of those things are property. Now, some people don't think that animals should be property. They are, okay? Legally, it's similar to a lamp. Now, do I equate a dog with a lamp? Nope. It's a living being and you love it. You don't particularly love your lamp. Of course, your lamp doesn't greet you when you come home. You don't turn around. My dog loves to go for rides in my convertible and get broken donuts. Okay? That's one of Sonny the Wonder Dog's favorite things to do on Saturday. It's like a fur storm. All the fur blows as they're going to the car. Okay? Your dog, all domesticated animals are property. Now, unlike a lamp, if I happen to knock the lamp onto the floor and break it, nobody's going to really get terribly upset with me. If I happen to step on the dog's leg and break it, people will. So we have specific rules, particularly with domesticated animals, you have to treat them kindly. Okay? There is no rule with respect to lamps. But realize legally, a domesticated animal is the same as other types of property. I can sell it, I can use it, I can fail to use it, I can take it for a walk, okay? Can't mistreat it, but I can do all kinds of things. I can use the e-put, exclude, possess, use, and transfer, all those things with an animal, okay? Property is all that more. But let's talk about Black's Law Dictionary, the best definitional standard out there for the law. What does it tell us the property is? It says it's the right to possess, use, and enjoy a determinate thing. An external thing over which you have the rights of possession and use and enjoyment. What does this tell us? Well, this guy, who is John Sprankling, and those of you who are a submarine student, I know you're a submarine student, I know you're a closet submarine student, you don't like to broadcast because you're a modest guy. But I know those of you who do will read John Sprankling's book, which is on the internet on our website. John Sprankling's Principles of Property Law talks about just what property is. What does John say? All the way at George Law School, California, he says property is rights. What did we say in the first class? What's going to be our first postulate? The property is a collection of rights. It's not the thing itself. It doesn't matter whether you own that water bottle. It's whether you have dominion and control over it. It's whether you have the legal right to use, possess, transfer it. Those rights in that water bottle are what's important. Your rights in your car, in your home, is what's important. If property wasn't a collection of rights, you wouldn't get to lease your house to somebody for as an apartment. You wouldn't have intellectual property. So when you write that great book, or sing that great song, or do that great dance that you do, you know, you come up with a men's own dance or something, you know what? That is all right. You wouldn't have intellectual property without rights. It's not the thing itself. It's the rights. And Sprankling makes that point to a T. Property is rights among people that concern things. That's what Sprankling's definition is. We talk about what is a right. We've talked about that ad nauseum in the last two classes. It's the ability under legal recognition to exercise power and control. If I have a right to do something, it means that the law recognizes that I can do something with it. If I have a right in property, it means I can exclude you from it. It means I can possess it. It means I can use it. And I can sell it or transfer it. Okay. The first postulate number one, comes right from this concept. Property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. It doesn't matter if you own something, if you cannot control it. What good is ownership if you're not able to use it, if you're not able to transfer it or possess it? Ownership is meaningless. Indeed, the term ownership did not even come into the law until about 1600. As we talked about the last two classes, there had been a lot of law before 1600, and property is one of the oldest laws. Ownership is a beautiful thing because it shows you about title. It's how you prove your rights. But it's not a right of itself. It's proof. That's all it is. Rights are where it begins and ends. If you have rights in your property, you have everything you want. So postulate number one, property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. This is the essential element that gives property its value. Because what's meaningful to you is your ability to use that property, to possess it, to transfer it, to exclude others from using it. Okay? That's what's meaningful to you. That ownership, that piece of paper, is not important. What's important is what it means. And it's only through this perspective of rights that we're able to broaden, as we say, our concept of property into things like leaseholds, like intellectual property, those abstract concepts. And when we get into real property, it's the ability to say, I'm going to give you future rights. Can you hold something in the future in your hand? No. Doesn't exist yet. But under that concept of rights, you can. Why? Because it's a concept, it's a legal right. That rights perspective makes property so much more fun, so much more valuable. It's all about rights. Why is this the first postulate? Because it's the most important. You don't get anywhere without it. Property is a collection of rights. You understand it as rights, you understand it. Okay. There's rights in three types of property. Property can be trisected into three areas. First, real property. Real property is land and things attached to land. That's called real property. Your rights are in the land or in the things attached to the land. What are the things attached to the land? Your house. Your house is, the land is built on top of it, or underneath it, or inside it, or around it. That's real property. Guess what? Are the trees in your yard real property? You bet. You own them too. So if you want to come down and turn them into firewood, you can. If you want them just to provide shade and be cool, you can. Okay? They have a value. If your neighbor comes and cuts down a tree, guess what? You could say, bad neighbor, I'm going to sue you. Because my tree has a value to me. It's my real property. And I'm letting that tree rights because it's real property. That's the first. Second, which is going to be the first few courses we take in here, first few weeks in property, personal property. Whereas rights in land are real property, everything else that is movable, that's not attached to the land, is personal property. Your car, that water bottle, the shirt you wear, the clothes you have, your bag, anything that's movable, that's tangible, that is personal property. Yes.
So with real property, why do you have to get like a permit to build like a fence or a bridge?
That's land use, and we'll get into that. Okay? It's government basically restricting your rights. Okay? Government can restrict it, but limit it instead to your big ones. Okay? But we'll talk about it. That's land use. With respect to these rights, personal property, you have a right to drink that. You have a right to turn around and use it as a football if you want to, okay? You can do anything you want with it as long as it is not injuring someone. Personal property is stuff, basically, okay? Your car, your glasses, anything that you can think of that you can hold in your hand, or even if it's big, that you can't. Now, what happens when you turn around and take a personal piece of property? I go to Home Depot, and I buy a set of curtains. If I buy those set of curtains, and I'm wheeling them out in my shopping cart, on Saturday, with Sonny the dog sitting in the car, that's personal property, okay? Why? Because they're movable. I can take them with me. But when I attach them to the wall, put them on books on the curtain rod, permanently affix them, they become real property. That's called a fixture. Okay? When I turn around and attach something to the home and make it permanently part of the land, that is real property. When I detach it, it becomes personal property.
So those two types of property can go back and forth a little bit. Those are called fixtures. Okay?
Lastly, the third area is called intellectual property. We're going to do a whole unit on this. Intellectual property, whereas real property is rights in land, personal property is right in objects, intellectual property is rights in ideas. It's one of the reasons why property is a collection of rights. Because if you don't have rights and ideas, your property's not a collection of rights, guess what? You don't have intellectual property. And there's three types of intellectual property. There's patents. That's you make the best mouse trap that was ever created. You have this awesome idea on how to create this gadget. This thing that nobody else, is usually seen on TV, okay? Those wicked things that you make, the guy who invented the windshield wiper that is periodic, okay? Made millions of dollars, sold it to Ford, they didn't pay right away, but after a series of lawsuits, multi-million, okay? There's a guy who lives in my former hometown in this unit. His name is Walt Robb. He was the head of the GERD Center. He invented all kinds of wacky whiz-bang stuff. You ever hear of the MRI machine? He invented it. Okay? He owns, he's a billionaire. Lives in his tiny little house. Never guess what a billionaire lives in his tiny little house. The reason he's a billionaire, he has to spend his money. Okay? He invented all kinds of wild stuff. Little white-haired old man, we know. Okay? He's awesome. But it's all out of intellectual property. He came up with these ideas. Trademarks.
Trademarks are logos. Looking for a sneaker here. Specific type of sneaker. Okay. Eric has got a logo on his feet. The Adidas logo, that's a trademark. In place, you see that little mountain that's on the Adidas? Guess what? That's their logo. The golden arches of McDonald's, that's their trademark. All those things are an identification with the product. Those things, the little swoosh on the Nike, all those items which you identify with a certain product, okay? Anybody ever see the little baseball player swinging on a Major League Baseball logo? That's a trademark. They're registered. It's part of intellectual property law. And lastly, copyrights. Copyrights, if you write a book, do a performance, have music, all of that can be copyrighted. You come up with this creativity, it becomes a copyright. And you get money anytime anybody wants to enjoy it. Okay? You have the right to do that. You can do a whole unit on intellectual property law, which is interesting. One last thing I will say about it, software. When software first came out, and believe me, I'm old enough to remember it because I'm an old guy, it was a question of whether or not computer programs were going to be a patent or a copyright. What do you think they settled on?
Copyright.
Why do you think that is? Because it's code. You write it. Okay? It's how you write that code that becomes the same as writing a novel. Okay? If I write code in a certain way, guess what? The program will do certain things, and as a result, computer programs are copywritten today. Okay?
How do you think Bill Gates made all his money? Copyrights! Okay? Okay. All right.
When we look at why do we have property rights? Why don't we just all share property? Okay? This is becoming a political question these days.
Why do we have private property? Why do we each have rights and property? There's five theories that are out there on it. First in time, first in right. It's a good way to allocate resources. That way everybody's not bumping into each other. Labor. If I'm working for something, I ought to be able to own it. If I put something into it, it ought to be mine. It encourages people to work hard and encourages people to keep what they do. Utilitarianism. If you want to maximize people's happiness, then you need to give them private property because people are happy when they have stuff. It's my stuff. It's an inherent human emotion to call it yours. Economics. If you turn around and give people private property, they will have wealth. That's good for your society. And lastly, which happens to be my favorite, it's a notion of liberty. Because if you have property rights, that means you have rights that are attached to you as a person. And those rights are respected. And the beauty of our country, when it is fulfilled in its potential, is we believe in the individual. And if you have rights as an individual, that means you're respected as a person. And that's the highest level we can go. Okay. So, to wrap up the first postulate, property needs to be seen as a collection of rights, not a collection of things, and all things are built off of that in this course. That's our first postulate. Okay. Property rights, as we said, are fundamental to our freedom and liberty. So, what's our second postulate? How does this get transformed into postulate number two? Remember, in order to have a right, you have to have a law to protect it. Because a right is a legally recognized ability to exercise dominion and control. It's just not you taking that right, it's a legally recognized right. So property in the law, in order for you to have that right, the law has to be involved. Property and the law are intertwined. This comes out of two people. One who is the father of natural law. Natural law believes that you have rights as an individual person. John Locke is that father of natural law. He wrote a book in 1690 called Two Treatises of Government, where he declared for the first time people have three principal rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. As we talked about in the first class, that got transformed at the time of the Declaration to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But Thomas Jefferson later declared, same thing, no difference. John Locke's viewpoint was inherent to our humanity. He says, you're a human being, you get these three rights. The Declaration expanded that and said, same thing. You get life, you get liberty, you get pursuit of property. Jeremy Bentham looked at it through a different prism of perspective. He's the father of a concept known as legal positivism. It's really a different way to look at the same thing. He says that the property rights you have flow from the needs of society, are practical, and are a creature of law. Well, he's not wrong. The difference is, one is a declaration. John Locke says, we have these rights. For being human, you get those three rights. You're a human being, guess what? You're born, life, liberty, property. You get those three things. Bentham basically says,
law protects those. Well, they do, because law, even under our system of government, protects our rights.
But you have to have the right for the law to protect it in the first place. Who was Jeremy Bentham? Everybody pretty much knows Locke, but who was Bentham? He was a brilliant lawyer, but one weird dude. Okay? We'll show you how weird in a minute. He was so brilliant, at the age of 3, he spoke Latin. That's the smart kid. I don't speak Latin, and I'm 56. Okay? My kids can, because I made them take it so that they could go on a trip to Italy. I said, you take Latin, I'll send you to Italy. Guess what? They just want to go there. How much they speak it? I can't speak it, so I can't tell, but I made them take it because I thought it'd be good for the SATs, and they're far smarter than their father. Bentham came up with this thought. It was more of an observation, and it's out of which we create our second posture. It's the observation that property and the law are born together and die together. You cannot have property without law. Why? Property is a collection of rights. Can you have a right without the law? No, because it's meaningless without it. You need to have the law to protect that property. That law protects the right. And he says, before laws were made, there was no property. Why? Because I could come up and take it from you. Is your right any good unless you have a law to protect it? No. That's what he's observing. Okay? He said, you take away the law, property ceases. And before the law, there was no property. So this is where we get our second postulate. Now, I was going to tell you what a weird guy he is because it's kind of interesting. He taught at the University College of London. He died there. He's still there. He put himself in this box. He's still sitting there in a chair. He didn't want to be buried. He wanted to be preserved inside this box in University College London. So if you happen to go across the pond and go to London, you can see old Jeremy sitting there in that straw hat in that box called an auto icon, which is a fancy name for a wooden box. He's sitting right there, kind of pickled. If you go to Moscow, you can also see Lenin laid out in a glass box, but he's at least lying down. This guy, he's sitting in a chair. Anyway. Kind of a weird dude, but he's there. So what is our second postulate that Bentham kind of inspires? What is it? It's very simple. Property rights are those recognized by law. They're intertwined, and the law evolved from property rights. A simple way to say this, property and the law are intertwined. Law protects your property rights, and law creates the property rights, and the property rights create law. How do the property rights create law? We're common law jurisdiction. We believe in stare decisis. We believe that cases will be decided based on precedent, right? So as a result of that, if you take my cows, but if you take my cow and I sue you, you get that cow back. That's a case in controversy, right? The judge will report that. So when I take your cow and look at that case and say, Bob, give the cow back. That is a system of law that is established under common law. So that law is created by property because it works in controversy and property. Most cases involve property. What do people most often sue over? I'll give you 3 guesses. 1, 2, 3 are always money. When I was a young practicing lawyer, and I was
tell you some stories about that. But when I was a young lawyer, somebody would come in and say it's not about the money. I would always look them in the face and say, it absolutely is about the money. That's the only reason you're here, and recognize it. It's always about the money. If it's not about the money, don't bother suing, because suing's very expensive. There is no principle. Okay? That's for the Department of Justice and other governmental entities to sue over. Private litigants sue over money. So when that is, recognize that money is property. So most lawsuits about property, they built that system of law, the common law.
The law created property because it built this system of law, and it protects property. It's intertwined. The law and property are interrelated. First postulate, property is a collection of rights. Secondly, law and property are intertwined. Okay? Okay. Property rights, as we discussed in our first lecture, were on the founders' mind when they created our nation. They talked about rights, but no right was more important to them than property rights. A king that turns around and takes everybody's right to life, not going to be king very long. Because if you have that kind of system of government, people tend to fight back to that. Okay? Dictators who murder their entire population tend not to last very long. The Stalins and the Hitlers of the world who are incarnate evil, they don't last very long. That's a good thing. What leaders who do sadly survive take property. And if you look at the Declaration of Independence, most of it talks about the property crimes of King George. It's the sections of the Declaration that most people don't read. It's kind of boring. Okay? It's not as elegant as the beautiful prose of Jefferson. But it's all about property rights. And when we formed our government, that was one of the biggest issues that they had. The founders understood that if you protect property, you go a long way towards freedom. Again, it was this concept developed by John Locke, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, the principal disciple of John Locke, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson paraphrases what he says by saying, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is the same as Locke's life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Same thing. What does the Declaration say? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, again, it's not a gender description, it's a mankind description, all people, if you will, are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence gets incorporated by reference into the Constitution. The Constitution lifts it up and puts it in it when it gets established in 1788. This foundation of law is all about property. Of course, it's about life and liberty, but it's also about property. It says you have that right as a person. You're born property rights. You're born property rights. Now, if your right comes from God, and we're the only nation that recognizes in law that your rights come from God. If you have a right from God, can the state take it away from you?
No. It's not a liturgical concept. This is not a class of religion, believe me, I'm not capable of teaching such. Okay? It's a class of law. And if you have a right from God, that means the government can't take it away. The founders knew this. Most of the founders were not really religious people. In this day and age, you call them spiritual if you want. But they really were not church people. Okay? The only one that went to church on a regular basis was George Washington. Most of them didn't. Okay? Particularly, if you read the writings of the guy who wrote the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson, he had a real lot of spiritual questions. He had a lot of questions in life. But when he wrote this, when he was asked about it, he said the principal value of having these declared as coming from God means the state can't take them away from you. They're yours. You're a person, you get it.
Now, people will turn around and say that these rights, these three principal rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, were not totally realized at the time they were declared. We still had slavery. We still had a property requirement to go.
Till 1840, New York State had a property order. Over time, we brought this war into adjustment. Because of these writings, we fought a civil war principally, that's what our case is about today, because the then President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, said that these words needed to be taken literally.
They may have taken until 1865 to come to fruition, but when they were announced, it was an earthquake. So what were our founders saying? We need to rethink government's role in recognizing property rights as a protector of those rights, not a grantor. You get it as a person. You're a person, you have these rights. Government's job is not to give them to you. Government's job is to protect. Okay. The same building in which they wrote the Declaration,
this is the Great Hall, today known as Independence Hall. They wrote the Declaration of Independence in the same room that they wrote the Constitution. Same exact room. Matter of fact, the first thing they did when they called the Constitutional Convention to order was, and it was in the summertime, they nailed all the windows shut. It had to be a pretty smelly place. They wore those long woolen coats. Anybody's ever been to Philadelphia in the summertime, it gets rather warm. You think it's warm in the back row back there, guys? It's cool compared to where it was in Philadelphia in 1787. The second thing they did is they kicked all the press out. So much more transparency, as they say. They weren't big believers in it back then. They said you get it when you get it all done.
Is what it is. But that's the building. That's the room. If you go there today, you can see the very room that they have. Pretty room. The first thing that you will say is, it's pretty small.
They wrote the entire Constitution, this little bitty room, which is about half the size of this room. Okay? It's not big, as you can see. Okay?
Great minds were in there. Guys like Jefferson. Guys like George Washington. James Madison, all in that room, different times, but they were there. Okay?
So what did they do and what is this third postulate? First, property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. Secondly, property and the law are intertwined. They're interrelated. You can't have property without the law. You can't have law without property. And thirdly, your property rights, which is your most important thing from the first postulate, are inherent to your humanity. They don't come from government, they're protected by government. They come legally from God. That means if you are a person, they're endowed to us from our Creator. It's declared in the Declaration of Independence, and it is confirmed in the Constitution. So the third postulate, property rights are inherent to our humanity. We get them as human beings. Doesn't matter how good a human you are. Doesn't matter what political strata you come from. Doesn't matter how wealthy you are or what economic status you have. If you're a human being, you have property rights. Okay. Rights of the people are property rights. The Constitutional Convention, as we said, put the Declaration of Independence within the Constitution. Once you have a Constitution, the Declaration of Independence wasn't effectual anymore. What did the Declaration of Independence do? It made declarations. It declared things. But it didn't have the effect of law. Matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, both said it was just a representation of the American mind. How did it become law? Why is it so revered today? Because those brilliant people in Philadelphia in 1787 said this document is aspirational. It's what we want to live up to. Even though they didn't always live up to it, it's what we want to live up to. And they put it in to the Constitution. The Constitution contains the Ninth Amendment. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage any retained by the people. What that says is the rights declared, because there's been Supreme Court cases on this, in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, they are protected by the Constitution of the United States. Okay? That all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with these inalienable rights. The Ninth Amendment declares this within the Constitution. So what are those first three postulates? Property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. Property and the law are intertwined and evolved together. And property rights are inherent to our humanity. They're endowed to us. What's the fourth one? The fourth is the operational postulate. I'm the world's worst golfer, but I use him as an example. I've never had an old golf ball. Most of my golf balls end up deep into the woods. I can hit it a long way, but when I hit it out, I put my weight behind it. But when I hit it a long way, it just like goes wherever it wants to go. Okay? But I admire people who can golf, like I admire all athletes, because I'm not one, as much as I wanted to be. If you look at these, think of a golfer. Why? Because the fourth postulate is E-putt. It's like the guy who putts. Okay? E-putt. Think of the electronic putting game. Okay? Mr. McElroy has a game out on Xbox. You want to play it. Okay? I see that the gaming convention is now coming to Albany. You can go watch it for $25. Sounds like a lot of money to watch somebody play video games. Would you go to that? No. I don't think I'm going to make an appearance either. But anyway. What is the fourth postulate? E-putt. They are acronyms. I like to give acronyms. You know why? It makes it easy. Okay? I try to give you acronyms. That way you remember. The last postulate is, what do you do with property? You have those property rights. You love those property rights. Because it's your stuff. What can you do with those property rights? Eat what? Exclude, possess, use, and transfer. EPUD. Exclude, possess, use, and transfer. What are these things? It's how we look and provide enforcement to property rights. Okay? Right to exclude. A lot of legal commentators say it's the most important property right.
I don't know that I
agree with that, but that's what they say. Remember that Finding Nemo movie? What did the bird say? Mine! Right? You ever watch Finding Nemo? Okay. What did the bird say? Mine! They want to exclude the fish from other people. Right? Exclusion is a property right. If you have something, you can keep others from getting at it. Mine! So as a result of that, exclusion is one of your principal property rights. It's not just that you have it, it's that all other people don't. You can keep people off of it. It's like the grumpy old man, get off your lawn. Okay? Don't play football on my lawn. That's exclusion. It's where the right of trespass comes from. Okay? Possess. Again, that's the flip side to mine. It's not that just you can't have it, but I do. Possession is the flip side of exclusion. If you can't have it, I can. Because I do, you can't. It's mine. I get to use it. That is the third one. Exclude, possess. Number three is use. Use is self-explanatory. I have a car, I get to drive it. I have a house, I get to live in it. I have that water bottle, I get to drink from it. Use is probably the most valuable property right. Because it's why you have property. You usually don't get property to prevent your neighbor from having it. Okay? Sometimes you do. My beautiful wife decided she didn't want a house next to our house in a vacant lot that was shared by the house next door for years. That couple moved out and they decided they were going to sell that lot. It's going to be a house 5 feet away from my driveway. My wife said, you know what that's going to do to our property value? I said, probably drive it down because they'll build a much nicer house than ours. She said, we can't have that. I said, well, why not? Well, we can't. Okay. We need to buy it. Okay. So I call up. Property which is valued by the town for $40,000 is on the market for $80,000. Did I want to spend $80,000 with kids in school to buy a piece of property that was going to use and do anything except for cut a lawn? Not really, but any of you who are married know, happy wife, happy life. Okay? So she says, call the neighbors next door and see if they want to go have some times. So I did, and they did, as long as I did all the legal work. So we buy this piece of property. For $86,000, we buy this piece of property, which Sonny the Wonder Dog uses to go to the bathroom, and I cut the lawn. Anyway, I have the right to use it.
right now. First of all, I had to take down 100 trees, some of which were big trees. Then Marilyn wanted me to fill in the holes in the trees. This has been like a multi-year project for a sunny litter box. It's okay. That property is mine to use. It's mine to exclude that other house from being built on it. That other house was starting to look pretty sweet for $86,000. Yes?
If you're moving, would you have to
like
get what you're going to do on
this
land at the other party?
Is
that with your neighbors? Because you
no, what we did is, Bob, being the lawyer, I was able to divide it in half. So they took their half and we took our half. I took that piece of property and did what's called subdividing it. So they got 75 feet of it, and I got 75 feet. It's 150 feet wide.
And like other things, so let's say I bought this
out where
I was like, nobody else
with
the other half of money.
Yep. If we owned it together, yep. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't cut the trees down without the neighbor's permission. Why? Because they owned it too.
And vice versa.
Exactly. I'm sorry? No one can sue me if I did something because they're owners. But that's one of the reasons we agreed to from day one. I didn't want that problem. And if they didn't clear their side, I just knew. I don't know why. Okay. Probably mistakes. But there were all kinds of animals that were boxing. It's like a wild kingdom. Okay. I got the trees. My neighbors laughed at me. Got poison ivy all over. And we lose an invention. It's great. But we subdivided the property, and now I can exclude, use, possess. And lastly,
what's the final T?
Transfer! So if you have a piece of property, you can sell it, you can lease it. You can give it away. I'm not going to give this piece of property.
Okay.
Huh? My children can have anything from me. Okay? They're girls. I'm the big daddy. I give them anything they want. I don't see my children. I don't give them. Part of the anything.
Someday they might have it. I think they don't want it, but they get it. Okay?
Transfer is the last right. Means you can get rid of it if you want. Okay?
By gift, by sale, or temporarily.
So what are these four postulates?
Property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. Property and the law are intertwined. Law evolved from property. Property evolved from the law.
Our foundations of the law say we are endowed with these property rights.
Our property rights come from God. That means the state can't take them away. And lastly, property or rights are summarized. What can you do with these rights?
Keep put, exclude, possess, use, and transfer. You now know everything you're going to need to know to succeed in this court. Those four postulates are the basis, Mr. Casey.
What about taking away our rights through taxation?
Well, we're going to get to that. We're going to do an element of taxation. There is a way that government and society can limit your rights. How do they do that? Your rights are protected by law. As a result of those laws, because our laws are made by us themselves, we are a nation of laws, they can limit them in certain areas.
Taxation is one of them, and we will talk about real property taxation, which is somewhat confiscatory, particularly in upstate New York. Okay, why don't we take a 5-minute break and we'll come back and do our case.
It is probably the most interesting case of the year. It's important. Come on,
call it?